Wednesday, February 25th. Once again, Columbia's correspondents in world capitals and in the fighting zones in the Western Pacific are ready to give you the latest news direct by shortwave radio.
And now for news of our own West Coast, we take you to Los Angeles and the report of Byron Palmer. Anti-aircraft guns went into action against unidentified aircraft in the Los Angeles area shortly after 3 a.m. Pacific wartime this morning. The anti-aircraft guns began barking during a blackout ordered by the 4th Interceptor Command at 2:25 a.m. The unidentified object, which some sources thought might be a blimp, moved slowly down the Pacific coast from Santa Monica and disappeared south of Long Beach. Army officials declined to comment on the possibility that the object might have been a blimp. However, it required nearly 30 minutes to travel some 25 miles. Far slower than an airplane. Watchers on the rooftop of the Columbia Broadcasting Building in the heart of Hollywood could plainly see the flashes of guns and searchlights sweeping the skies in a wide arc along the coastal area. Concussion of the shells could be felt in downtown Los Angeles, 15 miles away. U.S. Army planes quickly took to the dark skies, but whether they contacted the object has not been announced. Army officials say they will not comment until they receive a full report of the action. Although some watchers say they saw airplanes in the air, semi-official sources say they probably were the U.S. Army's pursuit. Several observers say they saw one or more planes spotlighted by 20 or 30 searchlights. The object moved southward, presumably over Huntington Park at the western edge of Los Angeles, and on southward to about Long Beach on the coast. By 3:30 a.m., observers said the object appeared to be over the south of Long Beach. Searchlights closely followed the object down the coast and kept it centered in their glare. Shells frequently could be seen bursting near the object, but none appeared to hit it. The shooting stopped about 3:30 a.m. The shooting brought warfare to the front door of this city of 1.25 million population for the first time since December 7th. Already, it was alert to the presence off the Southern California coast of a Japanese submarine, which had pumped 25 shells into an oil field north of Santa Barbara Monday evening. Because of the presence of the submarine, a three-hour alert was ordered at dusk last night, and civilian authorities stood at their posts while the Army and Navy continued their search for the submersible. The evening alert ended at 10:23 p.m., but another was sounded at 2:22 a.m., and the blackout followed within 3 minutes. It covered Los Angeles County from Santa Monica to Pomona. At 2:27, all Southern California radio stations were ordered off the air, except those in San Diego. Approximately 20 minutes after the firing died down, the ship returned and headed westward from Long Beach toward Santa Monica. The guns went into action again, hurling round after round of shells at the object. The second barrage appeared to be closer to downtown Los Angeles, since watchers could hear the concussion of the guns more clearly, and the flash of bursting shells was brighter. Then the ship disappeared for the second time over the ocean. We return you now to CBS in New York.
Welcome to Encrypted. I'm Lorette Love. My co-host is David Redding. What we just heard was a real news broadcast from 1942. It's amazing. One of the most amazing UFO stories I've ever heard. It's called Battle Over Los Angeles. And here to talk about it with us is Mr. Joe Janicek of the Fort MacArthur Museum Association. Welcome, Joe.
Hi, how are you?
Great. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Great, great. Can you set the scene right before this event? Didn't Pearl Harbor happened maybe a few weeks prior to this?
Yeah, just to give you some background, of course, we know that the Second World War for the United States began December 7th of 1941 with the Japanese attack at Pearl Harbor. And what a lot of people aren't really aware of is that after that attack, the United States wasn't really sure where the Japanese fleet had ended up going. Did it return back to Japan? Was it out into the Pacific somewhere? Was it heading north towards Alaska or, again, to reinforce the fighting in the Philippines? You have to remember is that both Pearl Harbor and the U.S. possessions in the islands of the Philippines were both attacked within a day of each other. So there was some confusion. You know, one of the options was that it was heading towards the west coast of the United States. And if it was heading towards the west coast of the United States, there was some discussion about exactly how long would it would take for a fleet that size to actually reach California and Oregon and Washington. You know, if you think about what happened to the United States on 9/11, we all saw that activity happening live via satellite. And back in the 1940s, that technology didn't exist. The fastest radio communication was, the fastest communication that we could have for news happened via radio. Typically, it was by newspaper. Television wasn't really a common device at the time. And so there were a lot of very nervous people along the West Coast, especially here in the Los Angeles area, because the bulk of our aircraft production and a lot of our ship production in the United States was centered around the greater Los Angeles area. It also didn't help that in the weeks after the Pearl Harbor attack, a number of ships were sunk along the west coast of the United States, including a lumber schooner called the Absaroka, which was torpedoed on Christmas Eve of 1941. So just a few weeks after the attack. I believe it was on the 23rd of February 1942, a Japanese submarine surfaced off the small coastal town of Goleta, just north of Santa Barbara, where it lobbed several shells from its deck cannon into an oil field, causing some significant damage.
I never realized that. That must have been terrifying.
Well, it was, and it was widely reported, of course, in all of the newspapers that this had occurred, along with, again, these sinkings that were occurring of American shipping off of our own coast. The nightly anti-aircraft blackout drills that were occurring throughout L.A., at sunset, oftentimes the Army would send out a message asking everyone to turn off all the lights in their homes, and municipal governments would turn off the street lights, and theater marquees would go dark, and people weren't allowed to drive on the streets because the headlights from the cars would give away roads, which could be used as maps that could be used by the enemy to find targets. So the civilian population as well as the military population were very concerned that there was an imminent attack on the west coast of the United States.
Yeah, so that really set the scene for this next event, which has been called the UFO Battle over Los Angeles, or also isn't it also called the Air Raid over Los Angeles?
Well, the general description I think that everybody has stuck with over the past 60-plus years is the Great L.A. Air Raid.
Okay. And so can you just tell us about the whole event for those who've never heard of it?
Sure. In the late evening hours of February 24 through the early morning hours of February 25th of 1942, there were a number of things that had occurred, and the best way to probably set the scene for you is to tell you about what the scene looked like from the general population's point of view. sometime at around 11 o'clock at night, you started to, basically, the Army detected something flying up in the airspace above Los Angeles. The coastal radar systems and detection systems were very much in their infancy back then, so there was some struggle to be able to fully understand the technology. At that point, a blackout was ordered throughout the greater Los Angeles and Southern California area. And at some point after that 11 o'clock mark, someone saw something flying up in the air, detected something, and started shooting. And that's a combination of both small arms, in other words, rifles, to large anti-aircraft guns, shooting shells, and in some cases weighed over a pound, up into the air. And as we all know, what goes up has to come back down again. So this shrapnel started raining itself down all over the city of Los Angeles, giving alarm to people thinking that we were actually being bombed, when in reality it's our own ammunition falling down from the skies. Several of these chunks of metal fell through people's roofs and into their bedrooms and into their homes, and there was a traffic collision that was caused by it, and one person who died as of a heart attack from all of this activity. But you have to understand what the scene would have looked like. It would have been a pitch black night. And a lot of us today, you can't imagine what the greater Los Angeles area looks like with no lights. Absolutely pitch black. Absolutely nobody running around, nobody doing anything. And then all of a sudden, all of these explosions going off from the cannons, plus searchlights sweeping the skies looking for aircraft. Radio stations would have been off the air, so there would have been no one to tell you what was going on. And people being left to their own devices will panic in that case.
Absolutely. So are you saying our military shot at this?
Yes, military did shoot this object. Today we would UFO is an unidentified flying object. In reality, over 60 years, we've done some research to be able to put a timeline together and have a better understanding of what was happening and what triggered all of this.
So, which armed forces were actually shooting at this? Army, Navy, Air Force?
It would have been both the U.S. Army. The U.S. Army Air Corps would eventually be involved. And the U.S. Navy.
Wow. Well, what's astounding to me is our armed forces were shooting at this thing, and apparently, from what I've read and, you know, about it, is that the ship or whatever this was never came down. It just sat there with all the lights shining on it and shooting going on it, all around it, and nothing happened to it. Is that correct?
Well, yes and no. The darkness and light will play tricks on people. There are those that believe that the Great LA Air Raid was the largest mass sighting of UFOs in our history, and that either something was shot down that night or it got away that night, and people will argue back and forth. Even Army personnel who were stationed here at Fort MacArthur, there's a 50-50 chance that if you find an eyewitness or two eyewitnesses that were here that night, that they would have differing opinions on what they saw and what was in the air. I've seen, for instance, the famous photograph that was taken by the Los Angeles Times that a lot of the UFO researchers point out as being positive proof that it was a flying object. But I also, the museum owned several of the searchlights that were used the night of the battle, and I know what optical illusions they will play when multiple searchlight beams come together in a single spot. So it's really hard to tell whether you could really say it was simply a UFO or two or more searchlights tracking a target of some kind up in the air.
Okay. So there were different theories on what it was, not including the UFO, but some people thought it was a blimp or a balloon, but then other people say that it wouldn't navigate that way. What do you think?
Well, what we know from interviewing eyewitnesses was, again, about a 50-50 mix of people will tell you that they heard engine noises up in the air. Others say they heard absolutely nothing, whatever it was that was drifting. What we've done is we've gone through, and you have to understand, we've been at this for about 30 years to try to put together a comprehensive understanding of what happened the night of the Great LA Air Raid. What we know occurred was a meteorological unit located at what we call Mines Field, which is today LAX. It used to be both a combination of civilian and military airfield. Back then, in order to get weather-related information, you oftentimes had to put balloons and sensors high up in the air with recording devices in order to be able to see what the atmospheric conditions were 1,000 feet, 1,500, 2,000 feet above your head. We know that one of these meteorological balloons was launched that night with a special strip of reflective metal on it that was designed to calibrate the coastal radar detection systems. And radar was a new technology back then, so it took a lot to actually get them calibrated. And we know that that particular cable broke loose, and one of these balloons was floating in the atmosphere above Los Angeles, being able to reflect radar. So that is more than likely what caused everybody's alarm, is to think that there was something floating around up in the air above L.A., being blown around by the wind, so it didn't stay in one place. It would have drifted, usually in a large circle around Los Angeles. We also know about the same time this was happening, a flight of P-38 fighter pursuit aircraft was taking off from Mines Field, heading for Lancaster-Palmdale area, and they were flying at a very high altitude. So that would explain the engine noises. And it may also explain why the searchlights were tracking a moving object along with the balloon and the inconsistent reports of the direction of travel of these targets. And we know all because we've actually managed to see the logs from the pilots that were actually involved with flying those P-38 aircraft and see a diary written by one of the guys in the meteorological detachment that said that one of their balloons got loose that night.
Okay. And then there are some other skeptics who thought it was a drill, like to prepare people. To me, that seems sort of unlikely because people got hurt during this. What do you think of that?
But also remember that it is only less than 2 months after, well, just about 2 months after the start of the Second World War. And the civilian population especially along the coastal areas of the United States, less so on the East Coast than the West Coast, because the East Coast had been seeing some effects of the European war for a year or two prior to the United States joining the war. But here in California, we didn't take these blackouts that were being ordered by the government all that seriously. People were continuing to have parties on Friday nights, and they were continuing to go out to the dance halls and the movie theaters. And, of course, theater owners were reluctant to shut down the outside lights that drew people in. It's just money, you know. And municipal governments had problems being able to coordinate ways to turn off the street lights at a moment's notice and just on a flip of a switch. We also had problems with people going around to people's homes and reminding them, hey, you know, you have to put up black curtains around all of your windows or turn out your lights when you're ordered to do so. So there are people that believe that this was a drill in order to help get or shock the civilian population into taking these things seriously.
Okay. All right. I didn't know that about the history surrounding that, so that's very interesting. I think we're going to take a break now, go to commercial break, Don, and we'll be right back with you with Encrypted.
Sounds great.
Long before you and I were ever born, a mystery was hidden. A code was devised. A secret was guarded. It is encrypted. The truth about the Holy Grail. Who is 666? What is the elixir of life? What really happened on 12/21/12? What astonishing secret is hidden in the Declaration of Independence? What if everything you learned about history, everything you believed about reality, everything you trusted for your future is a lie? What if the truth is encrypted? EncryptedTheBook.com.
In a moment, cancer changed our lives forever.
We were told nothing could be done to enjoy these final moments together.
But in that moment, when all seemed lost,
St. Jude Children's Research Hospital gave us hope.
Because at this moment, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital is saving lives with pioneering research and care. We're changing the way the world treats childhood cancer by sharing our discoveries with doctors and scientists everywhere.
And we'll never have to pay St. Jude for anything, ever.
At this moment, she wants to be in her own bed.
I want to be back at school with my friends.
I want to be outside playing.
Please take a moment and join St. Jude in finding cures and saving children. Visit stjude.org.
Every day, 80 children and adults are diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. Know the warning signs: extreme thirst, frequent urination, sudden weight loss. For more information, go to jdrfbayarea.org. That's jdrfbayarea.org.
Lamas I did rubane, drovagi kangalupa, dei salagopash.
As many as 3 million children and adults have type 1 diabetes. Join JDRF and help support the research that is delivering better treatments and ultimately a cure. Go to jdrfbayarea.org.
This is Encrypted with Lorette Love, David Redding, and our guest, Joe Genesec of the Fort MacArthur Museum Association. Hi, Joe. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So we were talking about skeptics and the 1942 air raid over Los Angeles. Can you tell us now a little bit about where this was first sighted? I believe it was in Southern California.
Yes, it was in Southern California, above the skies in the harbor area of Los Angeles, and the channel between Los Angeles and Santa Catalina Island.
And then what was the path? I read that it moved. It didn't just stay in one place. Didn't it go over the ocean and then came back or something like that?
Yeah, as I was explaining earlier, when the meteorological balloon that was launched out of Mines Field drifted in the atmosphere, it would have moved around according to the air currents that were here. So while I don't have an air current chart for that particular night, it is feasible that the winds would have blown meteorological balloon out to sea and then maybe south again. Changing air currents could have blown it inland, that sort of thing, especially when you get into the atmosphere a couple thousand feet overhead can be significantly different than what it is here on the ground.
Okay, so that's the skeptic side. I'm not sure which side you believe, but if you're talking about UFOs, let's talk about that aspect of it. From the UFO perspective, what do you think of that, and how would that differ from what you're talking about with the balloon being blown over?
Well, I try to keep an open mind. The history of Fort MacArthur has been sort of replete with urban legends and stories and sightings of different things. The fort is now mostly a city park, and we hear stories all the time of people wanting to know about the secret underground tunnel system that linked the fort with San Diego or Catalina Island or up towards San Francisco, stories of roads and underground passages, stories of a secret submarine base that was under the property, and of course the UFO stories with surrounds the great LA air raid. We've heard that a lot of times. Every year I get one or two people coming up to me and they're demanding to know where the flying saucer is that we shot down that night, and how they could see it or what we know about it. And we try to take all of this with a smile and work our way through the various stories. It's, you know, again, we try to keep an open mind, and we want to listen to what everybody has to say about it, so that as we work on the definitive story of it and work on the details of it, we've got all the perspectives.
Right. So what, as far as it being a UFO, what story can you tell about this event if it were a UFO rather than a balloon or a blimp or a drill?
Well, I don't really know what the performance characteristics are of a UFO. I mean, from an engineering standpoint, I would have to say that obviously if you can cross space, then you can move in ways and through a propulsion system that we can't even begin to understand here on the ground. Here in 21st century America or the world. So how would one move? I can't imagine how would one move. If you were here on a scouting mission to see what life was about here on planet Earth, I suppose Los Angeles would be an interesting place to get a perspective of that. So, you know, if somebody was looking, especially wartime America, you know, that might be interesting to somebody from another planet. Maybe somebody that doesn't understand why we have a need to fight against each other. Hard to tell.
And there were actually a lot of 1950 movies about that subject with UFOs.
Well, in a sense, you can imagine that the Great LA Air Raid was the kickoff point, in a sense, for what we would today call science fiction. As a matter of fact, a lot of people wouldn't know this, but I'm going to throw out a name to you, and we'll see whether you know it. But the editor of the Fort MacArthur's Post newspaper called The Alert was a man named Forrest Ackerman.
No, I don't know him.
All right, well, Forrest Ackerman was a famous sci-fi writer in the 1950s and 60s. As a matter of fact, he is widely credited with coining the phrase sci-fi. He used to have a big mansion here in Los Angeles called the Acker Mansion, where he had his science fiction props and stories, and he did some horror writing, so he had some of his stuff always on display. But at the time, he was in the time of the L.A. Air Raid, he was the Post newspaper editor, and again, his imagination would go on to spurn a lot of 50s and 60s sci-fi movies, a lot of them involving UFO aircraft.
So do you think it's a possibility that Hollywood used this as a kickoff for later movies? I mean, do you think they contrived it somehow, or?
I don't know.
Has anyone brought that up before?
There's a lot of, you know, if you apply the fine stroke of a PR expert to all of this, you could say that there were a number of incidences that the Army handled badly over time. One of the theories about the L.A. Air Raid was that whatever we shot down that night or were shooting at was the precursor to what happened at Roswell, New Mexico, which this week we just had, I think it was yesterday or the day before, was just the anniversary of the Roswell crash.
Right.
It's entirely possible that it was a matter of, all right, let's take, if you took the government at its word over Roswell and that it was a meteorological balloon or some other U.S. craft that had crashed that night, and they swirled the wreckage away and had one story or another, and, you know, that it really is face value, you know, there isn't anything to it. But if we shot down a UFO over Roswell, it's entirely possible that wasn't our first visitor that was coming here. And, you know, Roswell, New Mexico and Los Angeles, California, I mean, they're a stone throw away by our modern airplanes, let alone a extraterrestrial craft. So who knows, you know, it's entirely possible that maybe they came here in the 40s and then came back and visited us less than 20 years later.
Absolutely possible. And I think it was a few years later after the L.A. event that the term was flying saucers came about. I don't even think they had that term in 1942.
No, I don't think there was the term of flying saucers. I think that came out of Hollywood and the motion picture industry in the 1950s, again, the science fiction aspect of things. And, of course, it didn't help that in the 1960s and 70s, we had the U.S. Air Force having a project called Project Blue Book, which looked at all of the stories of extraterrestrials and flying saucers and tried to make an official government accounting of all of these various sightings.
Right, and wasn't that just released to the public recently in the past few years?
Well, I don't think that the whole Project Blue Book report has ever officially been released to the to the general public. That would take somebody that's more of an expert on that subject than I am.
Okay, all right. Well, yeah, that picture that was in the LA Times was amazing to me. I didn't think about the optical illusion aspect like you brought up, though. But it seemed to be, to me, to have the clearest early visual of a UFO that I've ever seen. I'm not a huge UFO expert or anything like that, but, you know, just the average person seeing it. When I saw that, I was just amazed.
Yeah, sadly, that photograph was taken very quickly. If the photographer had time to set up and we could get a clearer image of what the camera was seeing, it would be very interesting. You can make out some of the hills. You have to remember the photograph was taken several miles away from the epicenter of this incident. And camera technology of the 1940s wasn't exactly what it is today for clarity, for the ability to record images at night. Yes, you've got two beams of light crossing in there. There's something in the center of the beams. From the camera's viewpoint, it's easy to say by looking at that there's an object illuminated by those lights. But again, we run searchlights that are identical to those on a regular basis. There were hundreds of them in the hillsides, searchlights that were looking at various targets all night long. And just having a few of those lights operating as we do, they do create some incredible, interesting effects, especially when the beams of light come together at a point.
Yeah. Okay, well, do you have any of the photos or other information on this at your museum?
Well, the museum doesn't actually have any direct eyewitness photographs. U.S. Army soldiers didn't technically carry cameras with them. But of course, we've seen the L.A. Times photograph. We have seen some other photographs that were taken of that night. And all of them is, even with our the new computer technologies to be able to enhance photographs, all of them you would call, the results would be inconclusive. But,
right.
What we do have within the collection are eyewitness statements and, various information regarding that night. And we continue to collect information in the hopes that, we will have time in the near future to be able to publish works that maybe will be a definitive guide to that incident.
Yeah, that will be wonderful to have that there. So I have another question about the military involvement. Did any personnel that actually participated in it, like shooting at it or, pilots, did anyone ever speak out about that incident from the military?
Not immediately, but in the last 20 years, yes, we've met a lot of former service members that were involved. Like I said, including the pilot of the P-38, one of the pilots of the P-38 flight that was up in the air that night, and one of the members of the team that were operating the meteorological balloon that had gotten loose.
And what did they say?
Well, in the case of the optical team, they just simply said they had a balloon that got loose that night. And matter of fact, one of them showed me an entry in his diary that said one of our balloons got loose tonight, and damn if everybody isn't shooting at it. And like I said, we have the pilot's logbook that indicates he was in the air that night, but he didn't note anything that was out of the ordinary.
Okay. All right, so why don't you, in our remaining minutes, tell us a little bit about your museum and also the reenactment. You do a reenactment that I'd love to go to maybe next year. Can you tell us about that?
Sure, absolutely. The Fort MacArthur Museum is located on the former upper reservation of Fort MacArthur, which is today called Angels Gate Park. And it's located in the community of San Pedro, which is part of the city of Los Angeles. And we're a public-private partnership between the city of Los Angeles Department of Recreation and Parks and the nonprofit Fort MacArthur Museum Association, which funds the upkeep and maintenance of the facilities and allows the museum to grow. We have an extensive collection of Fort MacArthur's history, which the fort itself had a significant role in shaping both the United States military and our society in general throughout the 20th century. We are open Tuesdays, Thursdays, Saturdays, and Sundays from noon to 5. We have two special events that we do every year that are fundraisers for the museum. One is called Old Fort MacArthur Days, which is coming up this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, from 10 to 4, and it involves military reenactment groups from Roman legions out to the post-Vietnam era, showing what it's like to live in their particular time period, and they're doing combat demonstrations and cannon demonstrations and various reenactments. We also do a second event that's called the Great Los Angeles Air Raid of 1942, and that happens February at President's Day weekend every year. We bring in one of the best vintage bands in the country to perform, so that we have there's dancing in a historic setting here at one of the gun batteries of Fort MacArthur, where you can see a little bit about the history. Everybody comes in period attire. There's over 1,000 people that showed up this last year. And there's, like I said, there's music, there's dancing, there's good food and good entertainment, and people talking about what they saw that night, and there's a bit of a live stage show that happens around that, and it's really fun to see, and it's a good opportunity to learn about the event and about the time period and just enjoy an evening out under the stars.
Well, that sounds great, and I heard that Maxwell may be there being the host this next year. Is that correct?
Maxwell DeMille is our host of the event. He's one of the guys that helped us come up with this idea of the event, and he usually brings along some of the guests from the Cicada Club, located in downtown Los Angeles, that perform for us out here and give you a taste of what he does at his vintage club.
Right. He has a wonderful club. So how would people get, do you need tickets prior to the event?
For the event in February, for the Great LA Air Raid, tickets are always sold online through our website, www.ftmac.org, or through the event website, just called theairraid.com. For the event that we are doing this particular weekend, it's just drive on down and visit us at the gate. Tickets are tickets to the July event are $10 for adults and $5 for kids, and for the Great LA Air Raid, it's typically around $35 to get in for adults, but it's well worth the price, and it's well worth the drive down to the harbor.
Great, wonderful. Were there any closing comments or anything you'd like to say before we close tonight?
No, I just want to say that it's great that you're keeping this particular story about Los Angeles history alive. I'm glad for the opportunity to be able to educate people about our local history, an obscure piece of World War II history, and a great part of the fort's history. So thank you very much for having me on today.
And thank you very much for being on. So that's it tonight for Lorette Love, David Redding, and Joe Vanisus. Thanks again for being on, Joe. That's it tonight for Cryptids.